uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Paul Hackett, it appears, has lost the race in Ohio, but not without considerable influence from out of state. Not without a lot of questions being raised about voting practices in the state of Ohio. Gee, what a surprise! You mean there were places where people couldn't vote? You mean there were voting machines that seemed to be giving strange results? Could be. But it could be, too, that he just lost, you know, by a couple thousand votes. And if that's the case, then I think that we have to wonder about the sanity of the folks in Ohio. I mean, look at the job losses they've had. Look at the number. I've just heard 14 people from Ohio just died in Iraq just in the last 24 hours. And there was another, what, 6 or 8 the day before? So the blogs are all ablaze with discussion about, you know, the Cincinnati Inquirer, for example, the article, the Federal Bureau of Investigation interviewing members of the Claremont County Board of Elections because of a Democratic congressman's claim of vote tampering during the presidential election, and talking about stickers that were put on the ballots. This was back in the 2004 election. And, you know, could there be some hanky-panky, some shenanigans, you know, whatever you want to call it, going on there? Yeah, it's possible. It's possible. In fact, it's probable, given the Republican machine in Ohio. And I think it's fascinating to see the Democratic Democrats now are being characterized by some of the Republicans as running rigged elections. This is the new thing, the new Republican talking points. Oh, the Democrats, they're rigging elections. Right? You heard it first here. I'll be sharing more with you about that as the day goes on. But I think that the big lesson from Ohio, from this election, is, at least my carry-home message on this, is that we didn't pay enough attention to it. I'll put myself in that list as well. But nationally, it really would have been a good idea to be raising more money for this guy and getting him more publicity and more visibility. And that what we needed to be doing is looking at these small races and saying, you know, what can we do to make these more successful? Because certainly that's what the Republicans did. A lot of out-of-state money coming in to Gene Schmidt's campaign. A lot of out-of-state Republican money because, you know, that's what it takes in this day and age to buy an election, unfortunately, tragically. So, and then of course, you've got, you know, Rush Limbaugh out there calling Paul Hackett names, right? Rush Limbaugh, who got out of service in Vietnam because he had a pimple on his butt. I kid you not. I kid you not. And, you know, calling names to a guy who's an Iraqi war veteran. I mean, it's a sad day for conservatives, I'd say, you know, much less America. Speaking of, and you know, if you want to discuss that, you have thoughts on that, you know, you're welcome to call in our number 1-866-889-8894. And, of course, drop into our live chat room, TomHartman.com, click live chat, it'll take you there. I'd like to, however, move in, there's a couple of other things as well that I want to talk about today. And one of them is, oddly, the idea of steroids in baseball. And now, stay with me for just a second on this. Every time, the last couple of years, every time somebody starts talking about steroids in baseball, my eyes glaze over and my reaction is, that's not news. Who cares? It's just baseball. And you know, why is George Bush talking about this in his State of the Union address, for example? And in fact, in my opinion, there is no good reason. The guy is, you know, he used to own a sports team, and he thinks sports, you know, is the center of the universe, and it's a good diversion from talking about the real issues of the day. And there is a dimension to this that is not being discussed by the media, that in my opinion is the dimension that we need to attend to, and that we're not. And this is, for example, consider this: a nationwide survey of over 100,000 adolescents, right, kids junior high school age, middle school age, recently showed that 1 in 8 boys and 1 in 12 girls used products in the past year to improve their appearance, muscle mass, or strength. Most commonly, they were protein powders and shakes, However, some were using creatinine, amino acids, the hormone DHEA, growth hormones, and anabolic steroids. What has happened here is that, and USA Today, Elizabeth Weiss writes this article, adolescents bulk up their bodies. In the largest study to date on adolescents' view of their bodies and use of hormones and supplements, 1 in 8 boys and 1 in 12 girls reported using such products in the past year to improve their appearance. And almost 5% of teenage boys and 2% of girls use potentially unhealthy products, ranging, and anyhow, they go through the whole list. We have to start thinking of our community as a circle, of ourselves as part of a community, and not just what's best for the corporations that are trying to hype their products. We have created a cultureless society, what's increasingly being viewed as a society without culture in the United States, as a society without community, that is of, by, and for multinational corporations. And the primary way that these multinationals sell their products to us and to our children is by suggesting that there's something wrong with us. You know, the main message of most modern advertising begins with suggesting that we or that their target market are deficient or unhappy in some way. And then the second part of the message is, and therefore if you buy this product, you will become happy. And the reality is that, you know, in a community that life should be okay just from the get-go. That this isn't how it always was in America. This is a relatively recent thing. Really just the last 2, 3, 4 generations at the most. And there's something wrong with this. Other countries are looking at this and saying, hey, wait a minute, there's a problem here. You see, the whole consumerism thing in America is based on a truth and a lie. The truth is that if you're outdoors and it's cold and you're naked and you're all alone and you're hungry, you're going to be unhappy. We can all agree on that. Cold, naked, outdoors, alone, in the dark, hungry, unhappy. And if somebody brings you inside and says, here, sit by the fire, and here's some clothing to wear, and here's a place to sleep, and here's some food, you go from unhappiness to happiness, relatively speaking, fairly quickly. So there is a level at which, it's the bottom of Abraham Maslow's pyramid of hierarchy of human needs, if you will, there is a level at which there is a transition from not having enough material stuff to having enough material stuff, where we go from unhappy to happy, or uncomfortable to comfortable. That's the truth. The lie, however, is that, okay, if that amount of stuff is going to make you that happy, then twice as much stuff will make you twice as happy. 100 times as much stuff will make you 100 times as happy. 1,000 times as much stuff will make you 1,000 times as happy. 1,000,000 times as much stuff, you'll be 1,000,000 times as happy. And Bill Gates lives in a state of perpetual bliss. And it's just not so. And societies that believe that end up having to endure the tragedies of explosions and things like teenage suicide, which has been a terrible problem in the United States for certainly for the last 20, 30 years, as our consumeristic society has been just chewing up our kids, is exploding in Japan. And now in China, where the majority of teenagers in China identify Bill Gates as their favorite role model. In China, they're seeing an increase in teenage suicide, childhood suicide. New York Times had a piece on this last week. And around the world, we are increasingly being seen, as the Financial Times notes, as a culture-free zone inhabited by arrogant and unfriendly people. This is according to a study of 25 countries' brand reputations. Brand America. And why? Because brand America is increasingly perceived as brand corporate America. We have lost our brand around the world as the nation of democracy and of freedom, and we have become the nation in the minds of most of the world, as the nation of brand Walmart, brand McDonald's, you know, brand and brand war, tragically. I mean, George Bush has made a bad situation even worse. Susan Anholt, the author of this survey, the Anholt GMI Nation Brands Index, so the U.S. is still recognized as a leading place to do business, the home of desired brands and popular culture, but its governance, its cultural heritage, and its people are no longer widely respected or admired by the world. DDB Worldwide, the Business for Diplomatic Action Group, has said, the advertising group, Right now, the U.S. government is not a credible messenger. We must work to build bridges of understanding and cooperation and respect through business-to-business activity. Right. I think we need to be considering the possibility that maybe we should even be looking at the kind of legislation that many other countries have that limits consumer advertising, particularly when it's directed toward children. And says, you know, there are some populations that you can't just target to make a buck.
Oh, he's talking about government regulation.
Yes, we the people deciding, you know, we're going to limit the harm done to us by the groups that have become the central locus of our culture. It used to be that the central locus of a local culture was the local community center. Before television, people got together at the bowling league, they got together at the Moose Club, they got together at the corner store, they got together in their church, they got together through local community activities and they saw each other. And the arbiters of culture were the local people in the society, in the culture. Now the arbiters of culture increasingly are multinational corporations who own access to cable systems, in the case of local cable, who own access to national systems. You know, more people are familiar with national commentators and then local, you know, people spend more time with Chris Matthews than they do with their neighbors. This is not a healthy thing. And our children are getting more information from people who are trying to aggressively market brands to them, sell product to them, particularly sugar-containing products and image-enhancing products, than they are learning in our schools. In fact, our schools now, you have math textbooks, you know. Johnny has one Mars bar. If he divides his Mars bar in half, his friend, you know, how many halves will he have? You know, these kinds of things. I mean, they're actually using brand names in textbooks now. I don't know if Mars is one of them, but, you know, just for example. And, you know, Coca-Cola being sold, Coke doing these exclusive marketing agreements with schools. I think it's time for us to pull all this stuff out. And the whole thing about steroids in sports, it's just the logical endpoint of it. Of a culture obsessed with winning and with image. And see, that's the part of the story that they're not going to tell you. You know, when you hear somebody going on and on and on about, you know, if some sports figure who has been found to be having story, they're not going to be saying, gee, I wonder if this could have anything to do with a dysfunctional culture that has to do with the amount of corporate advertising that we have out there, or that has to do with the fact that we're obsessing on being on winning at all cost, and that ethics and morality have been set aside in the pursuit of winning. And might there be another way? No, you're not going to hear that discussion in the mainstream media. It's just, it ain't going to happen. So I wanted to raise the topic here. I just toss it out. So, you know, as you hear these things, you know, I know many of you are influencers. You're the people who call into other talk shows. You're the people who contact newspapers and magazines. You write letters to the editor. You talk to folks in your community. The next time somebody gets off on that, take it to the bigger picture. I think it's a useful step. We'll come back with your calls and others talking about Paul Hackett, Greenspan, whatnot, in just a minute. 20 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Duty to spend and to buy, to prove to Bin Laden I'll shop till I die. I'm a world-class consumer, I'm sure of my role. I vote with my dollars for corporate control. I'll prove that I'm loyal and rush to the store, where spending is my contribution to war. And the American flag's on the counter for sale. We're all made in China by prisoners in jail.
And welcome back, my friends. 25 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman, 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number, KJ in Camas, Washington, or Camas, Washington is on the line. Hey, KJ.
Hi, Tom. I may have mentioned before, you know, I work as a substitute teacher, and I've had a chance to watch some of the children's behavior. One of the things I notice, they really think it's cool to wear T-shirts with corporate logos.
Oh, sure.
And a lot of times, one way I handle this is I'll look at that and say, huh, a walking billboard. Phil Knight paying you to wear that?
Right.
You know, he pays good money for his billboard. You're going to wear his shirt. Heck, you ought to be getting some money for that. And hopefully that makes them think a little bit.
Well, have you had any indication that it does?
Occasionally a kid, the light will go off on his head, but unfortunately most of the time I get a blank look.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is sad.
Yeah, well, this is the culture wars here, KJ. Thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. These are the culture wars, and it's important, I think, right now that we begin taking back our culture, that we begin looking at these things and saying, you know, no, we're not going to do it. I mean, otherwise you're going to have these guys out here and, you know, standing up and lying to us about their products, for example. Yeah, just.
Yes or no? Do you believe nicotine is not addictive?
I believe nicotine is not addictive, yes.
Congressman, cigarettes and nicotine clearly do not meet the classic definitions of addiction.
I don't believe that nicotine or our products are addictive.
I believe that nicotine is not addictive.
I believe that nicotine is not addictive.
Yeah. I, too, believe that nicotine is not addictive.
Now, you tell me why none of those guys is in jail for lying to Congress. One of them was Lou Gerstner, who then went on to become the chairman of IBM, right? The big tobacco executives. Well, 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. And Vicki in Grand Rapids, Michigan, listening on WTKG. Hey, Vicki.
Hi, Tom. How are you? I just wanted to comment on Hackett. I really think that... the closeness of that race bodes well for the Democratic Party in 06 and 08.
I agree, particularly since he was in a very, very red area.
Like 70, 75% went for Bush in that Cincinnati area in 2004.
Yeah.
And I think, it also is a really good method of seeing of the grassroots working. And, you know, they got like $428,000, maybe more than that, through blogs and other methods. Within just the last few weeks to help Hackett and his campaign. And so then the RNC had to dump like $500,000 that they didn't expect to have to use on this particular race to back Schmidt. So, you know, I think it was a pretty powerful statement that people are not happy with Bush. They're not happy with the war.
Yeah.
And things have got to change.
Yeah,
so that's
I
my comment.
Thank you, Vicki. And I agree with you. In fact, well said, and I appreciate your bringing it up. Because the point is that here's a guy in a district that is three-quarters Republican who loses by basically more or less 1%. And what does that say about what's going to happen all across the United States? I am hoping that because Paul Hackett was willing to come out and speak out, you know, up front, out loud, and say, George Bush is an SOB, George Bush has lied to us. You know, George Bush was a deserter. I'm not sure that Hackett said that. I'll say that. George Bush deserted the National Guard during time of war. And then he says, can you let me out, please, early so I can go to Harvard Business School? And at the same time, he's sending young men and women off to die. And when they try and get out, they get prosecuted for it. I mean, aggressively prosecuted for it. And I suspect that this race, even though Paul Hackett didn't win the race, he darn near did. And that the closeness of that margin is going to cause Democrats, hopefully across the country, looking at the 2006 election, to say, okay, it is now time for us to begin speaking up. And speaking out. I mean, you had Rush Limbaugh yesterday going on about this for a half hour or so on his program, which is broadcast all across Ohio, you know, influencing an election. I mean, just the right wing just really, really, really pounding on this race. And they just got it by a whisker. And they should have gotten it by a landslide. 29 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
We voted on machines without a paper trail. Whoever brought us those touch screens ought to go to jail.
Right now, they ought to go to jail.
No more hanging chads, no more democracy. What's lost is lost, we have been had, screwed so thoroughly. Coup d'etat, oh coup d'etat. Here we go again, Ohio and Florida, where cheaters go to win.
And welcome back, my friends. 25 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman with you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, tomhartman.com, the website if you want to drop into our live chat room or participate in our blog, our message board. Dick in Corpus Christi, Texas. There you go, Dick. Hey, welcome to the program.
Tom, I wanted to call and tell you about Robbie Bacher's new book. It's called Greenspan's Fraud.
Dick, if you go
it
to...
It came out about 3 weeks ago.
Actually, it came out
it's
about...
It's an excellent primer for people to review their basic economics. And he tells the whole story from the time Greenspan was taken on as the chairman of the Fed, what he's done worldwide to the economy, to most of the working class.
Yeah, Dick, I absolutely agree with you. In fact, last month, I do a Book of the Month Club for a book review every month for BuzzFlash.com. It's how the website supports itself, is by selling books. And last month...
And another little thing I might want to add is that there's a thread of revenge, I think, that runs through the Bush family that sticks out every once in a while. And one of the reasons that... that Bush is so hard on lawyers and tries to do all this stuff is because he tried very hard to get in the University of Texas Law School when he was at Andover.
Yeah, and they wouldn't let him in.
And he couldn't get in.
Yep, you're right. Dick, thanks a lot for the call. And as I was saying, if you go to BuzzFlash.com and click on Tom Hartman's Independent Thinker Book of the Month, you will find that last month it was Ravi Batra's Greenspan's Fraud. It's an excellent book. In fact, Ravi Batra has been a guest on this program. I frequently refer to the book. Thank you, Scott. And it's one of the most important books that you can read. Absolutely agree with you, and thanks for the call and for pointing that out. 1-866-889-8894. Spike in Easton, Pennsylvania on the line. Hey, Spike, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Gonzo Greetings. Real quick, before I even get to my point, I just wanted to say that I am a TV radio major, and I needed to buy a couple of Macs recently, and I went with Small Dog because of their support for your show, and it was great service, percentage of profits go to great charities, and anyone out there, I highly recommend supporting Small Dog since they support this show especially.
Well, thank you. In fact, let me just say their telephone number is 1-800-511-MACS, 511-MACS for Small Dog Electronics, who's been sponsoring the show for over 2 years now.
Yeah.
Great company.
And I wasn't paid to do that. I honestly, it was a great company, and I was more than happy to spend $2,000 with them. Real quick, this whole thing with the guy out in Ohio, what I find interesting is you brought up a great point. The Democrats really didn't try to raise enough money, especially even around the nation, to help this guy out because of the money the Republicans would bring. I've always kind of been a little hard towards, you know, supporting causes outside of your area, but recently I've started to send $5 a month to Bernie Sanders for that very same reason, because I know Bernie's going to be up against Karl Rove money like it's going out of style.
Oh, yeah.
And I know we've always disagreed on philosophy about independence. You know, I've always been a Nader guy and a Ventura kind of guy. But I honestly, truly believe that even if you're not an independent, we really need an independent voice like Bernie Sanders, because Bernie Sanders speaks for the people and not the corporations.
I agree with you, Spike. And we need to also support the independent voices independence is probably the wrong word, the correct voices within both parties. I mean, frankly, I can't think of anybody in the Republican Party that I would support at this moment. But in the Democratic Party, I just got an email yesterday or the day before from Barbara Boxer, you know, all outraged about, you know, as I recall, it was John Bolton, all outraged about John Bolton. This was yesterday, saying, you know, we've got to speak up about this. And it had a link where I could send an email to George W. Bush, which I did. And I got an email back from George Bush thanking me for my kind email, right? The nonsense stuff. But the point is that Barbara Boxer is out there speaking out. And you know, contrast that with Dianne Feinstein, who's just kind of going along. And California's two senators are, you know, there's this increasingly visible contrast. And I hope that, you know, for all the talk about Hillary Clinton being the Democratic, a woman who can run for the presidency, the first woman who actually might have a chance of becoming the president of the United States. Frankly, I hope that Barbara Boxer is the woman who is that candidate. If there is a consensus that it's time for that gender barrier to be broken, and I think that there is, that it is. It's silly for us to say that, you know, gender should have anything to do with it. In fact, I think that, you know, testosterone is one of the most dangerous drugs in the world, and it would probably do us very good. But I digress. Nonetheless, I think Barbara Boxer would be just one of the finest candidates out there. I can't speak well enough about her. So, and Bernie Sanders, absolutely. And in fact, if you go to TomHartman.com, there's now a picture of Bernie halfway down our homepage, and you can click on it, and it takes you right to Bernie.org, Bernie Sanders' website. So, Spike, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Thanks for your kind words, and thanks for patronizing our sponsors. That's always important. That's what keeps programs like this on the air. Ed in San Juan Capistrano on the line. Hey, Ed, what's on your mind today?
Oh, the same thing about, we're talking about, basically parenting and you know, our attitude with the community and what's happening.
Yes.
We've kind of given up everything across the board, from politics to family.
Yeah.
You know, you and I are about the same age. Our parents wanted something better for us. We want something better for our kids. But in turn, you go to high schools today, and they're driving brand new Mercedes-Benz convertibles because we can't give them enough.
Yeah.
And then we wonder why they have this attitude of, well, okay.
Yeah. I think that there is something to be said. In fact, I think that there's a lot to be said for kids having rites of passage and opportunities to struggle and opportunities to have their own successes without them being handed to them. And I think that my generation, the generation, you know, if I'm in my 50s, my generation probably, most of us really struggled, or many of us really struggled, you know, I'm speaking for myself.
Amen, Tom.
And I think that perhaps in overcompensation we gave too much to our kids, although, you know, it's arguable, but I suspect that If you read The Fourth Turning, which is this brilliant book by Strauss and Howe about the generations, every four generations in America, this cycle comes around. They look at these 80-year cycles, and there's like the generation that comes out of crisis. And Ed, by the way, thank you so much for your kind comments and for calling in. There's the generation that comes out of crisis and war. For example, the generation that came of age during the Great Depression, and they then create their children, because of the experience that their children had being in that generation, their children become the quiet builders. The next generation, the next 20 years, they're like the quiet builders, and they build the country up. And then that generation of quiet builders produces a generation that reacts to the quiet builder-ness. You know, that, like the crisis ones are really struggling, then the quiet builders ones, their children are the ones who speak out and question things. And you know, just generally raise hell. And that was the generation that came of age in the 60s and 70s. And then that generation will produce children who throw themselves into consumer culture and who are acquirers, who are using the wealth around. You know, these are horrible generalizations, but, you know, there's some startling truth to this. And then that generation's pattern of living for today only, that fourth generation, produces a government and a culture that goes so deeply in debt and experiences such a terrible crisis of overconsumption, of you know, just general madness, that it produces another Great Depression and another war. And these guys, Strauss and Howe, in this book, The Fourth Turning, they also wrote a book called The Generations of America that points this out. They say every 80 years this happens, every four generations. And if you go back 80 years, it was the Great Depression. And you go back 80 years before that, it was the Civil War, and there was the Great Depression of the 1850s that led to the Civil War. And then after the Civil War, you had the quiet building generation, the 1860s, 1870s, 1880s. Then you had the conspicuous consumption of the robber barons, the 1890s then through 1920, the 1920s. And then you had the Depression again, you know, and boom, there you go. And you go back 80 years before the Civil War, and that was the Great Depression of the 1760s, which led to the Revolution of the 1770s. So you got Depression, War. And then you can follow that thing. You go back 80 years before that, and there was another crisis between what was not then the United States, but the colonies in England. And they take it all the way back to the War of the Roses. Every 80 years, they say these things happen in generations. I find it fascinating. Anyhow, a bit of a digression, but every now and then they're interesting to explore. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number, Will in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, listening on WPTT. Hey, Will, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, by the way, thank you so much for the other day. You're wonderful, I'll tell you what. I can't believe how well-informed you are. And you're no trash talk radio, man.
Well, thank you, Will.
I mean that sincerely, Tom.
Thank you. Well, and thank you for listening. I mean, tell your friends about us and tell your friends about the station. They're in Pittsburgh, WPTT. Let them know. So what's up? What's on your mind?
You mentioned two things. First, about Rush. What did you say? How did he get out of Vietnam? I'm a Vietnam veteran.
Rush got out of Vietnam because he had an infected pimple on his butt. It was a boil. And, you know, a boil, a pretty bad boil, is actually a medical condition that you can have to have surgery for in some cases, although Rush never did. And that's how he presented himself, as a guy with a pimple on his butt. And he got a medical discharge, a 4F.
4F. Oh,
well, some people have, you know, chronic pimple problems that get so bad that they're disabled, and that's how he presented himself to the draft board.
And you know what, Tom? I don't listen to him. I listened to him a year ago, and I tried him. My brother And I'll tell you what, he's the greatest war hawk I've ever listened to.
Yeah, well, that's very commonly the case with people who've never been to war but only seen John Wayne movies. I mean, look at all the people in the Bush administration. None of them had been to war except Colin Powell. And he's the one guy who kept saying, are you guys sure you want to do this?
Yes, you're right, Tom. He was the only one who said, wait a minute, let's pause for a moment here.
Yeah, yeah.
Tom, I know you can only give me about 33 seconds. I always listen to you, man.
Okay.
I really respect your ethics. Your ethics, Tom. I mean that. You're very fair on both sides. You just mentioned Barbara Boxer.
Yes, sir.
I'll tell you what. If they run Hillary, I have been an independent registered voter when I came home from Vietnam in 1967. I was 21 years old when I came home. I have been registered independent. I will never vote for a Hillary DeHunt. Never.
Okay. All right. Will, I appreciate your comments. And I have to say, for me, just speaking for myself, the verdict is still out. But, I don't know. We'll see. I have some very big concerns about Hillary Clinton. But I have a lot of concerns about a lot of Democrats. And you also have to consider what the alternatives are. I don't know. It's a little early to be talking about that. And I think that there is one lesson for us to learn from the Republicans, and that is that Ronald Reagan's 11th commandment, thou shalt not speak ill of another Republican. The Democrats, I think, and again, as an independent, I guess I'm not a Democrat, but I realize that we have a two-party system in this country, whether we like it or not. We have to acknowledge that. The Democrats, I think, need to have a little more unity. It would be just a fine idea. And saluting, Paul Hackett's valiant effort and Rush Limbaugh trash talking him, our Rush moment for the day. It's
condescending tribes making money selling lies. You might say everybody hates my guts.
Our Rush song.
I'm offensive. I'm a bigot. I'm a fraud. Can you dig it? I'm a sexist, racist, homophobic, fat, pathetic cuts.
And now we find the liberals doing what they always do, and I've told you this. They always try to give me 50 milligrams of Vicodin instead of the 80s.
I'm a Nazi.
Yes, indeed.
That's right. I really am, because I'm a Nazi.
Nazi.
That's right.
You're being scammed.
I'm a Nazi.
Nazi.
I don't care about the middle class, because I'm a fat conservative butthead.
Okay, we'll cut it off right there. Anyhow, our Rush moment for the day. It's gratuitous, but... sometimes it feels good. So, a lot going on in the world. The what on terrorism is particularly fascinating. Larry Johnson just published this thing. Stop the Press. The war on terrorism has been renamed. Of course, you've heard this. It's now the Global Struggle Against Violent Extremism. The acronym, of course, is GSAVE. G-S-A-V-E. Global Struggle Against Violent Extremism. Except that day before yesterday... when the press asked George W. Bush about the global struggle against violent extremism, he said, nobody checked with me when they came up with that name. Say what? The president insisted it was still a war as far as he was concerned. So now there's this scramble in the White House to try and figure out, what to call this thing. See, George Bush wants to call it the war on extremism. You'll recall, George Bush also suggested that the invasion of Iraq should be called Operation Iraqi Liberation. Now, if you do the acronyms of a war on extremism coming out of the Operation Iraqi Liberation, it's W-O-E, as in woe is me, on O-I-L, on oil. It's like, woe for oil. So, the focus group guys at the White House, we can't have that. So we got to call it the GWAT, the Global War on Terrorism. This, as Larry Johnson says, I realize this sounds like a skit from The Daily Show, but it's the honest to God truth, Apparently somebody at the White House, Johnson notes, realized that WOE, War on Extremism, would provide endless grit for comedy writers and decided instead to go with GSAVE, the Global Struggle Against Violent Extremism. The only problem with that is that when this gets translated into Arabic, the word struggle is translated as jihad. When it gets translated into German, the word struggle is translated as Kampf, Mein Kampf. And so the Germans are sitting there going, it's his Kampf? He wants to have a Kampf? And the folks all over the Middle East, a billion Muslims, are going, George Bush has just declared a jihad, because that literally is the word. And that might be why Bush is now saying, well, maybe it shouldn't be the G-Save, the global jihad against violent extremism, the global struggle. Maybe we should go back to the war on extremism, but then that's the woe is me, W-O-E, and that's a problem. And so what shall it be? Shall it be the W-O-T, the war on terrorism? Do we go back to that? Do we go back to G-Save? Somebody needs to find out W-H-A-T is happening, as Larry Johnson says. And I think he says it very well. It's like every agency and department in the White House, everybody's trying to figure this out. What shall we call this thing? We've got to rebrand it. Because calling it a war when we're losing doesn't seem to be a particularly good thing to do politically. Yeah. Oh, my. And it's a, you know, the thing to do, obviously, is to get our young men and women out of the way and let the Iraqis work this out. 10 minutes before the hour, I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends.
Find the cost of freedom buried in the ground.
And welcome back. Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number. Mike calling, listening on Sirius Satellite Radio. Hey, Mike.
Hi. I was calling about the death of King Fahd.
Yes, sir.
And what do you think the situation is that all of a sudden Bush is not going to go to his pay his respects? I mean, I thought those two were really close, and now he's sending Cheney over.
Well, you know, frankly, I don't know. I do understand that there is a cultural difference in the way that funerals are conducted between the Islamic world and the Judeo-Christian world, as it were, that we tend to make a big deal out of funerals. And perhaps I'm mistaken in this, but my understanding is that in Islam, you know, it's like you bury them quickly, and King Fahd is in an unmarked grave. You know, this guy who's worth 17 billion pounds, you know, $20 billion. And that, you know, there's more of the notion of, you know, your works live on, your spirit lives on, but you don't go visit the tombstone every week kind of thing. And so the whole idea of funerals may be viewed differently. But frankly, I don't know. I'm maybe speaking out of turn here. I'm not Islamic, and so I can't say. So I don't know, frankly, whether this is perceived by the Muslim world as a slight, that is, the big guy didn't go, or as, gee, you know, somebody's showing up for a funeral. Usually people don't show up, you know, except the immediate family. They're sending Dick Cheney. Wow, we're really honored. It could be one or the other, and I frankly don't know. I'm sorry. I will look around, though, Mike, and if I find out, I'll be sure and mention it on the air.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. 1-866-889-8894. Thurman in Omaha, Nebraska on the line. Hey, Thurman.
Hi, I was, there's a story that kind of is pertinent to the situation with the fellow and Hillary Clinton.
Okay,
and
we have about a half a minute here.
Okay, do you know the story of the president, or the dog chews a president? It's an American Indian story.
No, I don't. But
you should look it up.
Okay, the dogs chew the president?
Choose. Select.
Choose. Oh, yeah. Okay, yes. Who didn't smell? Yes, I know that story. In fact, I was at a Native American gathering that was at the University of Arizona. That is where I heard that. That was put on by the University of Oklahoma. I'm familiar with it.
I think we should tell that story often.
Okay. Let me figure out if I can figure out a way to make it radio friendly, Thurman, and we'll see. For those of you who don't know, Google it. Dogs choose the president, Native American. Yes, a good story. Thurman, thank you for calling from Omaha, and thanks for listening on Sirius Satellite Radio. It's a Tom Hartman radio program, the pill that will help you escape the matrix. You going to take the red pill or the blue pill? Maybe it's a green pill? No, let's go with the blue pill this time. The Democratic pill. It's a challenge.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Yep, every time Rush Limbaugh hears that theme music, he ups his medication. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 7 minutes past the hour. And the big buzz right now, or one of the big buzzes, as it were, is whether or not, well, one of the actually big debates, I suppose, on the left is whether or not George W. Bush is going to draw down the troops between now and next fall in Iraq. And I've been saying all along that we made the transition probably about 2 or 3 months after the invasion. We had a successful invasion of Iraq, you know, successful in military terms. I'd say diplomatically it was a disaster, but that's another topic. A successful military invasion, and then we had a failed occupation. 2 or 3 months into the occupation, we could have made a transition to an elected government and gotten out everything. You know, Bush actually could have looked good on this whole thing, but he wasn't willing to do it that way. Here we are now, a couple of years into it, losing soldiers. I mean, over 1,800 now. And, you know, just a terrible disaster. And so the Bush administration has been kind of leaking, well, not kind of, they've been leaking this information that they're going to draw down the troops to 40,000 to 60,000 in total numbers by in time for the elections in 2006. And over the weekend on the McLaughlin Report, I heard Bill Press, who, you know, represents the Democratic, has represented the Democratic Party in the past, a radio commentator, does a morning show on some of the same stations I'm on, and a good guy, Bill Press. I heard him say that he thought, you know, it wasn't, possible. You know, the Bush administration wasn't really planning on doing that, that this was just talk. And there actually is precedent for that. Just before the 2004 election, there was a leak, in quotes, from the administration that very, very shortly the Bush administration would be drawing down the troops in Iraq, bringing home, you know, as many as half the troops. And the administration then came out and denied the leak, which, of course, gave the leak more credibility and far more publicity. So all across America, people are hearing, oh, the Bush administration, there's a leak saying that the Bush administration is going to draw down the troops right after the election. And then they're denying it. But, of course, we all know how that works. I mean, they don't want the enemy to know what's going on. So it must be that if I vote for George W. Bush, that he will end the war. This is a variation, a very slick marketing variation, a very slick kind of advertising psychological variation on the old Nixon strategy of in 72 of, I've got a secret strategy to end the war in Vietnam. If I told you about it, it wouldn't work. But if you reelect me, I'll be able to do it, and then it will work. And the American people bought it. They actually believed Richard Nixon when he said that he and Henry Kissinger had developed a secret strategy to get us out of Vietnam. It was a lie. There was no secret strategy. But Americans bought it anyway. And, you know, we got what was going to be 4 more years of Richard Nixon, ended up only being a year and a half or so. And we'll see what happens with the Bush administration and legacy, how long it can last, given all the scandals and the apparent and obvious crimes that are being committed by these guys. And we're not talking about somebody having sex in the White House. You know, I think a lot of Americans would love to go back to the days when we had good jobs, a balanced budget, Social Security paying its own way, and the president was having sex in the White House. Yep, you heard me right. It's just not a big deal. I'm sorry. You go back to Thomas Jefferson if you want to have presidents who didn't have the very finest sex lives but ran the country quite well. Thank you very much. I'm really more concerned with how the country's running. That's what I elect the president for. But, you know, without going off on a rant about Bill Clinton, the point is that in the run-up to the 2004 election, the Bush campaign did this really slick bait and switch with Americans, suggesting that Bush is going to get us out of Iraq really, really quick. And of course, it was a lie. It wasn't their case. And so Bill Press was suggesting on the McLaughlin Report this weekend that he was of the opinion that that was the exact same thing that they were doing now when it was leaking out that they were going to draw the troops down to 40,000 to 60,000 by November 2006, by a year from this November, just in time for the next election cycle. I believe that they're actually going to do it. And I'll tell you why. And this is something nobody in the media is talking about, and no commentators are talking about. And I think it's a really important point. Pay careful attention to this, because I am pretty sure that I'm right on this. One of the things that these guys, keep in mind, the Bush administration is lacking, absolutely lacking in morality or philosophical consistency. Their only goal is to win and hold power and enrich their friends. That's what they're all about at every level. And therefore, although what I'm going to describe to you seems like a hideously immoral thing, it is right in keeping with the way the Bush administration does things. I mean, it's just right in keeping with it. Okay. What they have noticed is that the American people don't much notice what's going on outside the boundaries, outside the borders of the United States. I mean, you got the occasional cute white blonde who vanishes in Aruba or something like that. People will notice that. But, you know, outside of that, by and large, Americans pretty much don't notice what's going on in the rest of the world, particularly the rest of the world that's not white Europe. But we don't even much notice what's going on in white Europe. And so, for example, you know, after we pulled out of Vietnam, went through a transition. There's a lot of debate about what exactly that transition is like. But the fact of the matter is, most Americans didn't care. They just were out. Pol Pot is murdering millions of people in Cambodia. Arguably, you can trace that back to Henry Kissinger and the secret bombing of Cambodia, drawing it into the war, destabilizing Cambodia. Americans didn't notice. There's the Hutus are massacring the Tutsis or vice versa in Rwanda. Americans didn't notice. I mean, it's what's going on in Darfur right now. You've got to jump up and down almost every single day and say, hey, remember, there's people dying in the Sudan. And even when you get Colin Powell and Condi Rice going over there and saying, hey, let's pay attention to the Americans just don't notice. And so now take that logic to the next step, to Afghanistan. Afghanistan has been a complete and utter military failure. Now, let me back up just a little bit. There are those on my side of the fence who say, well, Bush would never pull our troops down to 40,000 because that would be an admission of failure. You know, if the country descends into chaos, if Iraq falls into a civil war, if Iraq ends up aligning itself with Iran, you know, that would be perceived as a failure on his part, and therefore he wouldn't do it. I'm telling you, Bush is not at all afraid to fail in reality as long as he can claim that it's a victory. And as long as he's got handmaidens in the press, in the media, and the right wing talk machine out there who will claim that it's a victory. And this is where we get to Afghanistan as the example in case. In Afghanistan, we have utterly failed. We went in to get Osama bin Laden. Osama bin Laden is still at large. Now, in England, in the United Kingdom, they get attacked by bombers. They get attacked by terrorists. What do? They use the police to track them down and arrest them. We get attacked by terrorists under the Clinton administration. They blow up the federal building in Oklahoma City. Kill several hundred people. It's a major terrorist incident inside the United States. Clinton used police, and he tracked down Tim McVeigh and executed him. I mean, you know, people got closure. Just like in England, people are going, oh, so that's the guy, and this is where he lives, and this is how it happened, and this is why he did it, and now we understand, and now we can do something about it. But George W. Bush utterly failed that test, completely screwed it up. We got attacked by terrorists, and he said, instead of saying, let's use the world's police to track this guy down, and to bring in all of his cohorts all around the world, he said, let's go in with bombs and armies. Armies are great for fighting wars. As anybody who's been in the military will tell you, what people in the military do is they blow things up and kill people. And they do it well, and from time to time there's an actual need for it. Because there's other people out there who are blowing things up and killing people who have to be stopped. But armies are not good at finding and prosecuting and imprisoning, taking out of society, terrorists. They're absolutely incompetent at it. And we've always known this. I mean, look at when the British were being attacked by the Irish Republican Army. Did they declare war on Northern Ireland? Start bombing Belfast? That would be stupid. They knew it would be stupid. When the Italians, when the Prime Minister of Italy, Aldo Moro, was kidnapped by the Red Brigades, they stuck him in the trunk of a car and drove off, and the guy dies. I mean, it's like the President of the United States being killed. I mean, the equivalent, although I as I recall, he was out of office at the time, said ex-president. But in any case, you know, they kidnap Aldo Moro, he dies. Did Italy say, okay, we think that these terrorists are located in Venezia or in Florence or whatever, you know, wherever, and so we're going to start bombing? No, that would be stupid. They knew it would be stupid. They used the police to track down and prosecute these people. In Germany, when the Bader-Meinhof gang was committing terrorist acts, did the Germans say, oh, we're gonna bomb that little part of West Berlin where they're hanging out, or we're going to bomb that part of, you know? No. They said that would be stupid. You don't use military. You don't use an army to take out terrorists. You use the police. So anyhow, Bush, we got attacked by terrorists. And Bush, who always wanted to, you know, he always thought war would be a wonderful thing as long as he didn't have to fight in it. He watched too many John Wayne movies. Bush said, oh boy, I can have a war now. And so off we go to Afghanistan. And the mission has totally failed. Bin Laden is still at loose. The Taliban still runs much of the country. And the rest of the country is now run by narco warlords who at least the Taliban had under control before. Now Afghanistan is producing so much opium that the price of heroin has dropped so far on European markets that it's become an epidemic across Europe, including in Leeds, in the very neighborhood where these London bombers came from. So many of their friends now are addicted to heroin coming out of Afghanistan that it's creating a cultural crisis that's breeding terrorist bombers. So Bush utterly failed in Afghanistan. Hasn't caught the guy who blew up the World Trade Towers and the Pentagon. Hasn't caught him. But nobody perceives it as he failed because he pulled most of our troops out of Afghanistan to send them to Iraq. And so nobody realizes that if you're an American soldier in Afghanistan, your probability of getting killed is actually higher than if you're an American soldier in Iraq. So the failure has been ignored. In fact, it's been celebrated. Limbaugh will tell you what a marvelous job Bush has done in Afghanistan. We liberated the country. So I'm predicting that he's going to do the same thing in Iraq. He's going to pull our troop strength down there. We're building these huge military bases along pipeline routes, you know, to protect the oil, basically. He's going to pull our troop strength down. They're going to confine themselves to the green zone and to these huge military bases that they're building. And so all of a sudden, there's not going to be any more American soldiers dying over there. And if a few Iraqis are dying, or if Iraq descends into chaos, Americans won't much notice because, you know, it'll be so dangerous that the press won't go out anyway. They'll just take their sound bites from the Pentagon like they are now. And we just had this reporter die over there. I want to talk about him when we come back from the break. And Bush will basically, you know, as Jerry Ford did, declare victory and come home. And I think it'll win for him in 2006. Gulp. 20 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
The fact is that they tell you lies. Renee, like oil, becomes democracy. The fact is that they tell you lies that then get different names, like collateral damage.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. 25 minutes past the hour. 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number, Alice in Humboldt County, California, on the line. Hey, Alice. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, Tom. We have been trying to access the exit polls in yesterday's Ohio election, and they can't be accessed. It appears to already be hidden from us.
Yeah, I don't think that there were any exit polls, Alice.
Pardon?
To the best of my knowledge, there were not any exit polls in the election, and that's why you can't find them. But there have been some folks who have been blogging about some problems with the election. I mean, there's a lot of concerns about this election, any election.
Oh, I know.
A lot of concern.
I suspect a repeat of what Congressman Conyers found there in 2004.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you. The system in Ohio is so corrupt, it is scary.
I know it.
Thank you for the call and for pointing that out, Alice.
You're, okay.
You're good.
Keep up the good work.
You too. You too. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Okay.
Thank you. Welcome back, my friends. It's time for our report from Washington, D.C. Is that Victoria Jones?
It is Ellen Ratner.
Oh, it's Ellen Ratner. Hey, Ellen. How are you?
Yes. Well, I have quite a bit of viewpoints on the Ohio situation.
Oh, great.
And one of them is that, first of all, yes, who knows? I mean, the Ohio situation is very scary with the kind of situation that they have with the electoral system there. And nobody questions that. But what is really interesting is this guy, an unknown with no big funding from the Democratic Party, pulled 48% in a Republican district that Portman pulled 70% in.
Right. This was the biggest mistake that the Democratic Party made this year, was not giving Paul Hackett more money.
Right. And the fact is that he was able to do what he was able to do is saying something very strong about where they're at. And I know the Republicans in this town are reading those tea leaves.
Yeah. Yeah. They're looking. You said 70% was carried by the Republican previously.
Right. And, Portman.
Yeah. And this time the Republican won with 51%, 52%. It's not a good sign for the Bushies.
Exactly.
And my hope is that because Paul Hackett came out and said George Bush is an SOB, he has lied to us, he doesn't have the, you know, he has not earned our respect as commander in chief. He was able to honestly say those kinds of things, that more Democrats will begin speaking the truth and speaking out, because I think that the Democrats have been so cowardly about calling George Bush what he is and who he is.
It's scary what has happened.
Yeah.
And it's really scary what's happened here. And so I think that, we are, seeing a situation where, that the Democrats have got to pay attention to the movements, some of the kind of movements you're talking about, or they're going to lose every election.
Yeah, David Sirota's
been
blowing.
You've got Hillary Clinton deciding on what she wants to do, with the Democratic Leadership Council. But there's a lot of people out there that if they come out two in the middle, they're just going to say, screw it, we're not voting, or we'll put our own candidate up.
I agree. If the DLC runs the next two campaigns, it's going to be the end of the Democratic Party, in my opinion.
Well, and a lot of people say it might.
Yeah, and something may emerge to replace it. It may be like the Whigs, when the Whigs imploded in the 1830s, but it'll be a bad time for America.
Right. Very interesting. Jay Carson, who you may remember from the Dean campaign.
Mm-hmm.
Jay was the Dean campaign spokesperson, and now he is replacing Jim Kennedy. Jim Kennedy is now going to run Sony Pictures Entertainment, interestingly enough, and Dean Carson is now going to be working for President Clinton.
Interesting. Interesting. Former President Clinton.
Former President Clinton.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Well,
yeah, well, you still call
right.
him President Clinton, don't you?
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Also, that Whackbird guy with the Hillary Now group.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I know this guy. I don't understand why he is doing this except to get himself some publicity.
Yeah, well, that's, you know, politics brings those folks, you know, the Dick, what's his name, the guy, what's Dick's last name, who was the chairman, who worked in the Clinton campaigns and is now on Fox News.
You got it.
You know who I'm talking about. Anyway,
right.
Yeah, it's that kind of sleazy person comes out of the woodwork. Ellen, thanks a lot.
You got it.
Good talking with you. It's 29 minutes past the hour.
Who make up 10% of the population. Latino immigrants have the lowest health costs at $962 per person.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
I said, hold it, Doc. A world war passed through my brain. He said, nurse, get your pad. The boy's obviously insane. He grabbed my arm, and I said, ouch, as I landed on the psychiatric couch. He said, tell me about it, you dreamed.
Yeah, tell me about it, you dreamed. Welcome back, my friends. Tell us about it, Bob.
Well, the whole thing started at 3:00 fast. It was all over by 4:15. I was down in the sewer with some little lover when I peeked out from a manhole cover wondering who turned the lights on.
Welcome back. 27 minutes before the hour. I'm Tom Hartman. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, tomhartman.com, the website if you want to drop into our live chat room. Nick in Pittsburgh on the line. Hey, Nick, what's up?
Hey, Tom, what you were just saying there about the elections coming up in 2006 and the troop withdrawals.
Yes, sir.
I couldn't agree with you more, and I wish that every person in this country would realize just how pathetic this administration is, because everything that they've done here, the reason why everything is a debacle to me in a situation as it is because all their considerations, all their decisions have been based on politics.
Or money.
And not sound money, but not sound policy, not anything about, you know, it has nothing to do with anything else except their elections, their previous elections, the coming elections, elections in Iraq, elections in Afghanistan, and look where that process has brought us, you know, look what it's brought us around to, you know?
I absolutely agree. Yeah.
Dave. And at the same time, I'm sorry, and at the same time also, the election in Ohio with Hackett, there's something in the Democratic Party, okay, that they don't want any outsiders getting into their circle, because they did it with Howard Dean in 2004 and even the other candidates out there. Kucinich, well, he was in. He was already as a representative, you know.
Yeah, but what you're describing, Nick, is simply the nature of political parties. It's an aspect of you know, just human nature here. And the solution is for progressives like you and me to be doing what the conservatives did after Barry Goldwater went down in flames in 1964, and they said, okay, we're going to get active. We're going to get active inside the party. Pat Robertson in the 1970s said, you know, that he and his church guys were going to take over the Republican Party. He started infiltrating the party. The defense contractors infiltrating the Republican Party, and, you know, with the Committee for the Present Danger, Don Rumsfeld's group that was in the 70s talking about how the Soviets had secret weapons of mass destruction. Turned out not to be so, but in any case, you know, that they had super technology for submarines and things we didn't know about, space technology we didn't know about, and the fact that we didn't know about it was proof that it was there, right, says Rumsfeld. And so they infiltrated the Republican Party, took that thing over, and, you know, now the outsiders have become the insiders. We need to do the same thing with the Democratic Party.
No doubt about it. And I called now to hopefully point this on. I'm sure there's a lot of other people that can see it and feel it and understand, too. But you're absolutely right here, too. You know, we got to speak up and forget, you know, proactive is the only way to go here.
Yeah, well said. Thank you, Nick. I appreciate the call, and thanks for listening. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, and... I do want to talk about Steve Vincent. We'll get to Steve in just a second. First, Ronald in Bennington, Vermont on the line. Hey, Ronald, what's up?
Hi, Tom.
Hey, Ronald.
Oh, hi. I listen to your show every day, and I think it's great.
Thank you.
I think there's way too much of this right-wing talk show out there, like Rush Limbaugh and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I totally can't stand the Christian right there. Use God for everything to their spin. It's like you go out, like, these ones shooting people at abortion clinics and stuff. I mean, they criticize, like, someone like the Symonese Liberation Army or something, and say, oh, the left is terrorists, but yet they condone it.
Yeah,
and it's like totally doublespeak. It's like George Orwell.
Yeah, and you know, good point, Ronald, and thank you for your kind words and for making it. I mean, it's absolutely what's going on. Tom in Grand Rapids. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I want to lighten your day.
Okay.
Got a comparison here for you.
Okay.
A woman in a hot air balloon realized she was lost. She lowered her altitude and spotted a man in a boat below. She shouted to him, "Excuse me, can you help me? I promised a friend I would meet him an hour ago, but I don't know where I am." The man consulted his portable GPS and replied, "You're 30 feet above sea level. You are 31 degrees, 1497 minutes north latitude, and 100 degrees, 49.09 minutes west longitude." She replied. She rolled her eyes and said, "You must be a Democrat." "I am," replied the man. "How did you know?" "Well," answered the balloonist, "everything you told me is technically correct, but I have no idea what to do with your information. I'm still lost. Frankly, you've not been much help to me." The man smiled and responded, "You must be a Republican." "I am," replied the balloonist. "How did you know?" "Well," said the man, "you don't know where you are or where you're going. You've risen to where you are due to a large quantity of hot air. You made a promise to that you have no idea how to keep. Then you expect me to solve your problem. you're in exactly the same position you were in before we met. Somehow now it's my fault.
Yeah. Okay. Tom, thank you.
Yeah. Bye.
It's a good one. I've heard it before. It's been floating around the web for a while. It's a good joke. And normally we have a rule about you. Please don't read things on the air. But it was a good joke. So anyhow, I want to move on to Steve Vinson. Steve, in part, tipping my hat to somebody who did the kind of work that in some smaller way I've done, that is, you know, writing about what's going on in a war zone during a war. I did this in Africa back in the early 80s, and Steve Vinson was doing this, although Steve on a much larger, I mean, Steve was writing for the New York Times, and I was just writing what became my own books. Published by real publishers like Random House and all that sort of thing. But nonetheless, Steve really, he had the ability, he had the opportunity to live in the green zone, to be completely safe, to be completely protected, and to only get what the Department of Defense, the Defense Department, spoon-fed him, like all the other reporters were doing. And instead, he said, no, I'm going to go out there and actually live among the people and find out what's going on and get to know them and tell the story as it truly is. And for this, last night, he was murdered. He was shot in the head, and his translator was shot in the chest. She's in the hospital in serious condition. He's dead. In the New York Times this last weekend, just 3 days ago, he wrote an op-ed, or he wrote an article about what was going on in Iraq. Here's just one paragraph from it, two sentences. An Iraqi police lieutenant, who for obvious reasons asked to remain anonymous, confirmed to me the widespread rumors that a few police officers are perpetrating many of the hundreds of assassinations, mostly of former Ba'ath Party members, that take place in Basra every month. He told me that there is even a sort of death car, a white Toyota Mark II, that glides through the city's streets, carrying off-duty police officers in the pay of extremist religious groups to their next assignment. And the death car apparently has caught up with Steven Vincent. And in all probability, because he had the temerity to speak up about this. Steve Vincent now dead. His translator seriously wounded. Now, Steve Vincent, he's from New York. He's a New Yorker. And one of the really great pieces he wrote, I just want to share a little piece of this with you. It's called The Naive American. And it was published, in the Christian Science Monitor. And he writes it as a letter, you know, Dear Lisa. And he talks about how this Air Force captain is, you know, all full of enthusiasm. He says, you know, asking the people who passing out the money to rebuild Iraq, asking people to write their proposals in English, no more than a single page, please. The audience of some 200 Iraqi contractors, some of them women, nodded and jotted down the captain's words in their notebook. Not surprisingly, given Basra's dilapidated condition, contracting is a big business, writes Steve Vincent. Not only for the city's numerous contractors, but also for the crooked politicians, parasitical religious parties, and criminal gangs who take their cut from every construction job, creating a business climate that combines the accountability of Tammany Hall with the law and order of 1920 Chicago. So he, with Lila, or Layla, I'm not sure how it's pronounced, L-A-Y-L-A, who I believe is his translator, and he decides to sit down with this official, this captain, United States Army captain, who's passing out millions and millions of dollars, and give him, you know, just talk with him about it, find out what's going on. So he says, so it was one recent afternoon. Imagine sun so hot it burns the moisture from your eyes. We taxied out to Al Basra Airport, where the captain was stationed. He met us at the gate and drove us into the UK base, deciding en route that because of the heat and our thirst, we might best conduct the interview in one of the two bars provided for MNF troops. Stepping into a crowded, sunny, air-conditioned room, we found the usual atmosphere, rap music, the low buzz of conversation from intermingling men and women, a large-screen TV playing a video of half-naked women cavorting around a fat, unattractive man, the smell of beer and cigarette smoke, the clink of pool balls on the felt. The only difference, of course, was Lila, her pink headscarf standing out among the Guinness pints and 16-ounce buds, like a WTU banner in a frat house. This was, I realized with a mild start, her first ever visit to that symbol of kafir corruption, a saloon. So anyway, he buys everyone a round of orange juice, and they're sitting and talking with the captain. And he's talking about how he's awarded $19 million in contracts, passed out to, from a multi-million dollar police station renovation project to a few hundred dollars for printers. He says he's operated on his own, reading from Steve Vincent here, he operated on his own, he said, relying on common sense and past job performance records to select Iraqi contractors. He did not use a translator, one reason he asked for Iraqis to complete their bidding forms in English. Steve Vincent writes, this last point was important. Layla and I have heard numerous stories about how on big multi-million dollar projects, Iraqi translators and engineers, which means the Americans, British, and non-Iraqi NGOs, are forced to use because of language difficulties. The Iraqi translators and engineers often accept bribes from companies to steer contracts their way. Since most Westerners don't speak Arabic and must rely on the translators and engineers as their eyes and ears, the funding sources are rarely the wiser. Now the captain is speaking. He says, in my case, there's just me, my database, and the Iraqi companies. No chance for corruption there. He says, I'd wanted to introduce Layla to the Gary Cooper side of America, and I felt I'd succeeded. Instead of the evasive, over-subtle, windy Iraqi, fond of theory and abstraction, here was a to-the-point Yank, rolling up his sleeves with a can-do spirit of fair play and doing good. I want to have a positive effect on this country's future, the captain averred. For example, whenever I learn of a contracting firm run by women, I put it at the top of my list for businesses I want to consider for future projects. Steve Vinson writes, I felt proud of my countrymen. You couldn't ask for a more sincere guy. Layla, however, this is now his female translator who's with him. Layla, however, flashed a tight, cynical smile. She's Iraqi. She says, how do you know that the religious parties haven't put a woman's name on the company letterhead just to win the bid? Maybe you're just funneling money to extremists posing as contractors. Pause. The captain looked confused. Religious parties? Extremists? Oh, boy, writes Steve Vincent. Masalama Gary Cooper, as Lyle and I gave our man a quick tutorial about the militant Shiites who have transformed once freewheeling Basra into something resembling Savonarola's Florence. The captain seemed taken aback, having, as most Westerners, especially the troops stationed here, little idea of what goes on in the city. I'll have to take this into consideration, he said, scratching his head. I certainly hope none of these contracts are going to the wrong people. Not for the first time, writes Steve Vincent, I felt I was living in a Graham Greene novel. This about a U.S. soldier, call it the naive American, who finds what works so well in PowerPoint presentations has unpredictable results when applied to realities of Iraq. Or is it the story of our whole attempt to liberate this nation? And he continues, it's just a marvelous piece. Steve Vincent, that's Spence Publishing, S-P-E-N-C-E, publishing.typepad.com/in_the_red_zone. You probably find it fairly easily just by Googling Steve Vincent and In the Red Zone. It's his blog. It's the blog he's been keeping from Iraq. And if you want to get a real startling, brilliant sense of what's going on in Iraq, I recommend you check it out. One of the things that Steve Vincent was pointing out about what's going on in Iraq was that the right-wing religious parties, the Pat Buchanans and Jerry Falwells of Iraq, have risen up and taken over at the city level in much of that country. In Basra, for example. That's where much of his reporting has come from. And he says, down Basra way, the country's most preoccupying the locals is not America, but that brooding, seething, over-clericked Mordor to the east, Iran. Whether it's supporting religious parties, smuggling oil and gas, sabotaging the energy infrastructure, orchestrating sectarian assassinations or other neighborly deeds, Basrawi detected the stealthy hand of Tehran in nearly every aspect of their lives. We don't talk about this in public, a professor at Basra, you told me. Get too explicit, and you get disappeared. This, you know, the warning us about the dangers of theocracy. This is something that our founders saw. One of the reasons, read Ben Franklin's autobiography, one of the reasons that he left Boston. When he was a child in Boston at the end of the 1600s, they were still hanging women in Boston Common as witches. And he got out of town. He said, that's it. It was Massachusetts was where the Puritans first landed after they got thrown out of England. You know, they tried to take over that government, held it for a few years, and, you know, Cromwell now. Then they left. And Franklin was like, enough already. And in fact, it was Massachusetts that nearly seceded from the United States because it wanted to be a theocracy during Thomas Jefferson's presidency. But in any case, Franklin was like, you know, we don't want a theocracy here. And that's why they built a wall of separation between church and state in the United States. And what you're seeing is that wall breaking down in Iraq. And now they're putting this into their constitution, that Iraqi law is based on Islamic law and Sharia law. And, very, very difficult time coming for the people of Iraq, as Steve Vincent has been so...
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
It's up, dubs on the Cadillac, white tees, Nikes, gangsters don't know how to act.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Just to wrap up the day, the events of the day anyway. We still have another hour of the program, but the events of the day. Dick Cheney is heading off to Saudi Arabia for the memorial for King Fahd. And he's asking reporters to go with him. You know, please, you know, give us some publicity, you know, but here's what one editor wrote to his staff to entice them to volunteer for the assignment. Quote, most of the brief time on the ground in Saudi Arabia will be spent holding at the U.S. Embassy. In addition, they tell me there'll be no access to Cheney on either the outbound or the return trip. Filing after the meetings, if any, would be from the U.S. airbase near Riyadh, where Cheney's landing. Plus, there's this added attraction. It's expected that whoever volunteers for this trip will land his or her news organization with the airfare for the trip and any other expenses. End of quote. Yeah. Me. Good old Dick Cheney. And now we find also in Treasongate, more of Karl Rove's aides have been called before the grand jury. This is raising a lot of eyebrows. It's becoming increasingly apparent, I think, to many people that, for example, Susan Ralston, who works for Karl Rove at the White House, and Israel Izzy Hernandez, a former Rove aide, have both been, Friday of last week, were both brought before the grand jury to testify. They're narrowing in here, clearly, on Karl Rove, also known as Turd Blossom, the official nickname that George W. Bush gave him many years ago, still has. And this could be a challenge, could be a problem, shall we say, for the Bushies, as their act of treason is outed. I mean, what are they going to do? What are they going to do? Remember when Spiro Agnew, some of you may be old enough to remember when Spiro Agnew was vice president of the United States, and it became apparent that he was going to be indicted for criminal corruption back in, what was it, Delaware, New Jersey? Wherever he was from, someplace, one of the states back east, and Agnew resigned. I mean, you can't have a guy as vice president who's being indicted. I would argue that Karl Rove actually has more power right now than Spiro Agnew had back in 1972. And I'm pretty sure I'm right. So what's this guy doing? Still running our country, running the Republican strategy machine? As it's becoming increasingly evident that he committed treason against the United States. We'll just see how long these guys can hang on. I think that they've got a big extra pass because they own so much of the right-wing media. But Americans are waking up. We are waking up, guys. And we're not going to take it anymore. We are waking up.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. This is the man who uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back to our program. Alex DeBrow is with us. Alec DeBrow. And Alec is with the International Labor Communications Association, ILCA. I called it ILCA when I gave this speech last week, and most people don't call it that, though. They call it ILCA, right?
Actually, all our speakers call it ILCA. It's just easier to do.
Oh, okay.
But,
all right.
We tend to call it the ILCA.
Yeah, because I noticed.
But that's fine.
I noticed in the awards thing in the evening that it was always ILCA, and so I thought, maybe I committed a faux pas here. But anyhow, thank you for inviting me to speak last weekend in Chicago.
And great. You were great. Thanks for coming.
And it's great to see people representing the media in organized labor, which is what the International Labor Communications Association is all about to a large extent, getting together and talking about the future of labor. And it's what I'd like to talk with you about today, Alec. You're right in the middle of it. You know what's going on. There has been this big split in the labor movement now. And what's your take on what this is going to mean for the future of organized labor?
Well, it's interesting. What it's going to mean, that's a tough one. I can give you a few insights on what it seems to mean right now today, which might help a little bit. After you came to our convention, the AFL-CIO's convention began just down the street from us, and I attended that. And here's something that happened there. At the AFL-CIO, they invite a lot of foreign labor leaders, and a Brazilian one gave a speech. And it was pretty ordinary speech, but a day later I ran into him and his entourage at Starbucks, which is probably a story in itself, given that they're from a coffee country. But I asked him through the interpreter, what did he think about this split in the labor movement? And he said, well, this is a very serious matter, but I think the American working class will find its way to solidarity. And I said, that's interesting. How many labor federations do you have in your country? And he thought, he said, cuadros. No, cinco. They have five. He couldn't even keep track of the number of them. And I bring that up.
And this is not unions. This is federations of unions.
That is federations, because the rule throughout the world is more than one federation in a country.
Yeah.
Rare is the country that actually has one. And in truth, in the history of the United States, you and I have lived through that only period in which there was a single federation. And you and I have lived through that anomalous period in the United States when we had a high union density. It's not been historically the way things have gone. And the truth of the matter is, we don't know where this is heading, whether this is a destructive split or a constructive act or a combination of the two. But as I said, you know, it's been more frequent to have competing factions that are frequently federations. And that doesn't spell the death of the labor movement. That doesn't mean I'm taking sides in this. I want my friends and everybody I work with to understand that my organization has no position on this, no formal position.
Well, it's not like there's a pro-split, anti-split axis any longer. It's a done deal.
It's true, but that doesn't stop there from being a lot of resentment. And being, as we're an allied organization of the AFL-CIO, the AFL-CIO is concocting a number of rules that either permit its affiliates to work with formally with the dissenting unions, or forbid them for being within the AFL-CIO structure. Mm-hmm. So it's complicated, because different actions take place on the local and state level than they do on the national level, and this has all yet to be sorted out.
Yeah, and without devolving too much into inside baseball, which will glaze over our listeners' eyes.
Absolutely.
I would like to point out that if we look back at the history of the labor movement in the United States, the period of time when the labor movement was growing the fastest, the 30s and the 40s and the early 50s, was when the American Federation of Labor and the Congress of Industrial Organizations were competing labor federations.
That's absolutely true.
And there is, you know, one of the negative stereotypical brushes with which labor has been painted over the last 30, 40 years by Republicans and the anti-labor Reich in the United States is that it is a monolithic, some even have referred to labor as, kind of Stalinistic group. And I think that that criticism, it's overblown, obviously, but I think that there might have been, just speaking for myself, I know you can't take a position on this, but speaking for myself, it seems to me that there might have been not a grain of truth in the criticism edge of it, but in the point that whenever one group comes to completely dominate everything and holds power for a long period of time, they tend to get kind of stale, you know. And
I agree. And
the same
frankly,
thing with political
a lot of
parties.
People agree that, you know, I mean, there are a lot of reformers within the AFL-CIO itself who will say the same thing. You know, they're careful never to name names, but the truth of the matter is, you're absolutely right. That's why the whole concept of checks and balances is so important in any large organization.
Yeah.
You cannot have, you know, an unbroken skein of power in the same way. And yes, there are some similarities to the SEIU Teamsters UFCW group that split off with the CIO. There is one important difference, however, which was the CIO, which began as a committee within the AFL, was in fact kicked out. They didn't leave voluntarily. They were proposing changes within the AFL, which were voted down, and voted down resoundingly.
Hmm.
And it turned out...
What year was that, Alec?
That was in... They first brought it up for a vote in 34, they failed in 35, and they were kicked out in 36.
And this is right around the time of the Wagner Act was passed in 1935.
That's right.
Which gave labor some power in the United States.
That's absolutely right. But the CIO was arguing in favor of wall-to-wall organizing within industries, and the AFL was wedded to the craft union model. And the old craft unionists did not want any part of this, which frequently organized less skilled workers, immigrants, even women, and they didn't like it.
So
hang
on just a second.
The CIO was right.
Let me just to understand here. The craft unions are those, like the machinists, tool and die workers. My dad ran a tool and die shop in Lansing, Michigan for almost 50 years, I think. And the guys who were members of that shop were members of the Tool and Die Makers Union,
mm-hmm.
and or whatever it was called. I think that was the name of it. And it was a very specific specialty. I know one of my brothers got membership in the union, and it was a long apprenticeship. You had to go through, I mean, it was a serious skill trade. Once you got your union card, you had a job. You know, you could get a job anywhere in the country, at least before Reagan got a hold of the economy and started ripping it apart and sending all the tool and die jobs overseas as well as everything else. Is that what you mean by a craft union as opposed to a more general sense of unionizing just entire industries, period?
Yes.
And that was the split between the AFL and the CIO back in the early days, the AFL?
Yeah. In broad terms, that's true. I mean, that as you point out, is a very specific skill. That's more analogous to like a medieval guild in a sense, or
right.
that they had. I mean, but the railroad workers were considered a craft, and they were broken down into several. You know, the brakemen, the trainmen, the firemen, and tenders. Each of them had their own union,
mm-hmm.
and those were considered to be crafts, and they were more or less skilled or technical. At the same time, truck drivers were considered a craft union, and the Teamsters were within the AFL. And frequently, unions had to fight to become part of it,
mm-hmm.
particularly if they employed less desirable people, such as people of color, you know, immigrants, women, that sort of thing. But the CIO was all in favor of what they called wall-to-wall organizing. That is, everything within the plant, everything within the company, everybody down to the people who swept the floors. And a lot of the AFL people did not like that.
And that's more of the cloth from which the SEIU and the a couple of these unions, Teamsters even, has broadened out beyond. You know, these unions are organizing in much more horizontally, much more broadly.
Well, interestingly, almost all unions have diversified
okay.
for a variety of reasons, but SEIU was born of that, so that it sort of comes naturally to them to think in those terms, where others have to break out of the earlier molds. And perhaps that's the reason why this kind of impetus came from that union first, that and the fact that they have a charismatic leader who seems to know where he's going and what he's doing. And but, you know, as I said at the beginning, where this is going to go, I haven't the faintest idea. There are any number of possibilities that could happen. They are having their constitutional convention, their founding convention as a permanent coalition in October in Cincinnati. And I think we'll see there what it is that they really intend to do and who joins them, whether any more unions pull out of the AFL-CIO.
What do you see as the movement, as the future of labor in the United States in general? I noticed that there was another story in the paper yesterday about how the Bush administration had a major victory against labor.
They are stacking the deck. It was another, I think what you're referring to was a National Labor Relations Board ruling.
Yes.
That members of a, that workers at a security company could not fraternize with each other outside of work.
That's right. They couldn't talk to each other when they're not at work. And I'm
right.
And in fact, I sent that off to Louise because I thought this is something, I need to rant about this for a half hour. I mean, this is outrageous.
Yeah,
the NLRB ruled this.
Yeah. Well, which is why so much union organizing now just steers clear of the NLRB altogether, does not care what their rulings are. I mean, the issue in that workplace, and that frequently involves face-to-face negotiations. And what these rulings do, cut down unions' ability to be able to compel employers to do it through the courts of law. But labor law has always followed labor actions. You know, first, whatever labor has sought to do has been illegal.
Yeah, and that's at least that's the position of the Bush administration. But we've been talking with Alec Dubrow. Alec is with the International Labor Communications Association, ILCA. Their website, www.ilcaonline.com. It's .com or .org, Alec?
Org.
.org. Thank you.
We don't make money.
Okay, that's right. ILCAonline.org. Alec Dubrow, thanks for being with us, Alec.
We'll talk more about this later.
We
bye-bye.
Will. Yep, 20 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
I'm just an old truth teller. I'm your candid friend.
And welcome back, my friends. 25 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you. Last weekend, Iraqi police and a brigade of the 5th Iraqi Army Division formally took control, full control, of an area in Diyala province to the northeast of Baghdad known as Khalis Kadah, replacing a U.S. Army unit. Colonel Archie Davis, spokesman for General George Casey, the top U.S. commander in Iraq, said the transition was made because the Iraqis had demonstrated their proficiency at fighting the insurgents without U.S. support. I'm telling you, Bush is going to turn Iraq over to the Iraqis between now and the elections in 2006. This is going to be the October surprise for the 2006 elections. The Republicans are all going to be running around saying, see, we did it. Everything's fine. You're not going to see the news coverage of the horrors that are going on in Iraq. Women will be back behind the burqas, which they were not under with Saddam Hussein. The religious Reich in Iraq will have taken over the country, as they are very quickly now. The death squads will be continuing to run around, as they have been ever since we sent just Death Squad John Negroponte over there as our ambassador. All of a sudden, after Negroponte goes over, just like when he went down to Honduras, all of a sudden, dead bodies start showing up all over the place. Death squads start running around. Well, you know, it worked for him in Honduras. He thinks it'll work in Iraq, apparently. So, I'm telling you, they actually are going to withdraw. I can virtually guarantee it. They actually are going to pull down our troop levels. And, you know, the chaos that ensues, actually, probably a lot of stability will come out of it. I mean, here's an example of the administration doing the right thing for the wrong reasons and probably the wrong timetable. I think they should probably be withdrawing a lot more rapidly. But, they've got it. Number one, you can't use an army to stop terrorism. You have to use police and culture to stop terrorism. And number two, they're losing. And, you know, what do you do when you lose? You declare victory and get out if you want to maintain, you know, save face and maintain any kind of political power. And the Bushies are all about saving face and maintaining political power. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Speaking of saving face and political power, the Fitzgerald and Plame investigation on Mary's Mine in Grand Rapids. Hey, Mary, what's up?
Yeah, the special investigation's been going on for 2 years now. How come it's taking so long to get all the information out?
Well, Mary, you've got to remember, it is a large administration, and there are a lot of senior officials.
And I don't know. We're going to find out. The senior administration official. Now, this is a large administration, and there's a lot of senior officials. I don't have any idea.
So, Patrick Fitzgerald has a big job.
Is there any hope of it coming to a head soon?
Well, it's going to be real interesting in October to see what happens, because in October, his commission, as it were, runs out. And either he will be renewed or he will go independent on this thing, and or he will have wrapped it up. And all the indications are that he's trying to wrap it up before October so that there won't be a battle over this. And if he does, then we may see indictments sometime in the next 60 days.
Is that going to get the lady reporter out of jail?
Hard to say. I doubt it. In fact, I think the lady reporter is complicit in this, frankly. Judith Miller, she was with the New York Times, and she wrote a whole series of articles quoting Ahmed Chalabi and quoting under deep cover, you know, as an anonymous source, quoting Dick Cheney in the New York Times, saying that Saddam actually did have weapons of mass destruction, did have chemical weapons, he was working on nuclear weapons, you know, blah-de, blah-de, blah. She was one of the main people who helped lie us into this war. And there's a lot of speculation right now that the reason why Judy Miller chose to go to jail rather than testify is because if she had given testimony before the grand jury, she would have had to testify in a way that could have caused her to be either revealed as a stooge for the administration inside the New York Times, on the one hand, A, or B, as one of the people, or as criminally complicit, as one of the people who actually might have even been a source of the information about Valerie Plame. In other words, she might have been part of this right-wing conspiracy all along, and so she's trying to cover her butt and keep her reputation as a journalist intact rather than testify. Who knows? Who knows? Maybe she's the plucky reporter who's really standing up. But if you look at the kind of reporting that she did before this, I'm very suspicious of her.
Thank you very much.
Okay, you're welcome, Mary. Thanks for the call. It's and you know, it's a terrible thing to be saying about, you know, a reporter who's in jail. I should absolutely be on her side. And with regard to standing up and saying, I'll go to jail rather than give my source, I am on her side. But Judy Miller is the wrong person for all of us to have as a poster child, frankly. A lot of problems with Judy Miller. It's 29 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. Yep, hot time in the city. I'll tell you, the heat wave that is exploding across this country, bringing, you know, ever more severe thunderstorms, like the one that apparently took down that plane yesterday in Toronto, and ever more severe hurricanes, like coming out of the Caribbean here. This heat wave, and it's not just the United States, by the way, bizarre weather all over the world, increasing, and nobody in the American media wants to talk about global warming. They have been slapped silly by these front groups for ExxonMobil and other companies like them. So to the point where they're terrified to mention it. You're certainly not going to hear it on NPR, for example, National Republican Radio. Tragically. I mean, the real what we need to do, by the way, with public broadcasting, just as an aside, is we need to fully fund it so they don't have to take money from corporate sponsors anymore. And give them complete independence so that they don't have to answer to government. And just let the chips fall where they may. And you know, the BBC has done a marvelous job. Deutsche Welle does a great job in Germany. It's a national media. Well, but that's a whole other rant. We'll get onto that some other time. But in any case, we speaking of the media, CNN has pointed out that a couple of nameless Iraqis who were quoted by the U.S. military, said the exact same thing on different days. See, this is one of the problems when all the reporters, this is why I'm saying, this is one of the problems when all the reporters are in the green zone behind the barbed wire. This is why I'm saying they will pull down the troops. They will reduce the troop levels in time for the November 2006 elections, and Americans won't notice what's going on in Iraq. Americans won't notice that for the average Iraqi, Iraq is worse off than it was under Saddam Hussein. Because our reporters won't report it. Because if they go out, they'll be like Steve Vincent. They'll get shot in the head. Steve Vincent, rest in peace. Anyhow, here we had one Iraqi about a month ago saying, "The terrorists are attacking the infrastructure, the children, and all of Iraq. They are enemies of humanity without religion or any sort of ethics. They have attacked my country today, and I will now take the fight to the terrorists." End quote. Eerily quoting George W. Bush. And then on July 24th, a few weeks later, the Pentagon issues a news release that's picked up by all the media, and the media reports it as if it's just the news, in which another anonymous Iraqi is quoted as saying, and I quote, "The terrorists are attacking the infrastructure, the ISF, and all of Iraq. They are enemies of humanity without religion or any sort of ethics. They've attacked my country today, and I will now take the fight to the terrorists," said one Iraqi man who preferred not to be identified. Yeah, he preferred not to be identified because his name was Karl Rove. So anyhow, this has come to the attention of the Pentagon that they've been outed on this, and they've just said, okay, we're not going to do it anymore. Actually, they said this was an egregious error. Pentagon top spokesman said, his Associated Press story today, in a memo aimed at preventing it from happening again. Okay, you guys, in military intelligence, and, you know, Karen Hughes is here. She's now running the show. She's making sure that everybody gets it, that anything the Bush administration does is wonderful. And if you're going to make up quotes, be sure that on different days you make up different quotes. You can't have the same made-up quotes a couple of days in a row. You've got to have different made-up quotes. And everybody in the military goes, uh-huh, yes, sir, got it. And everybody in the media says, okay, great, just send us some new quotes. We'll take them. Yep. In the meantime, domestically, this weekend, the New York Times pointed out that the Bush administration has been using, or has used so far, $250 million of your tax money and mine, $250 million to produce phony public relations, phony government PR, $250 million. Now, this is against the law, by the way. Since President Bush took office in 2001, notes the American Progress Action Fund, the White House has spent at least $254 million on fake news segments and other public relations schemes. In a now infamous segment by the Department of Health and Human Services, a PR official named Karen Ryan posed as a reporter interviewing then-Secretary Tommy Thompson. Government Accountability Office found the agency designed and executed her segments to be indistinguishable from news stories produced by private sector television news organizations, according to the Times. Now, how is this against the law? Well, the Nonpartisan Government Accounting Office, the GAO, the investigative branch of Congress, which has no partisan agendas, not run by political parties, not affiliated with political parties, it works for you and me. The GAO has forbidden federal agencies from creating prepackaged news reports. Said you cannot create a news report, quote, that conceals or does not identify for the television viewing audience that the agency was the source of those materials, end quote. How did the Bush administration respond to this, to the GAO, saying, okay, we've read the law, and here's what the law says? The Bush response was in Friday's New York Times. And I quote, "The Justice Department and the Office of Management and Budget circulated a memorandum instructing all executive branch agencies to ignore the GAO findings." Just ignore it. It's only the law. K Can you believe this? $250 million that this administration has spent in the last 5 years promoting fake news to make them look good and to convince us to vote for their programs and vote for their people and buy into their worldview. And the GAO says it's illegal and the administration says ignore them. Just ignore them. And, of course, the Bush administration wants us to ignore their actions in this regard as well.
Pay no attention to that man behind the curtain.
Pay no attention at all to that man behind the curtain, please. Well, I'm telling you, it's time for us to pull that curtain back and take a look at what's going on. Rod Page, the outgoing education secretary, he's the $240,000, $250,000 that he gives to Armstrong Williams, the right-wing African-American commentator to promote No Child Left Behind. He says it's just fine. He says it's a standard outreach effort. A group of senators have asked the Education Department to turn over some records regarding this. Page, not so excited about that. Ranking Democrat on the House Education and Workforce Committee, Representative George Miller of California, criticized Page for neither apologizing nor pledging to put an end to covert propaganda efforts. Of course, Page figures, hey, he's got the power. He has the ability. He can write the check. He doesn't care if it's legal or not. This administration is all about breaking the law and getting away with it. In addition, Federal Communications Commissioner Jonathan Edelstein said the FCC should investigate whether Williams, who hosts a talk show, broke the law. You know how far that's going to go. But as far as you can roll a stone, as far as you can roll a brick, how's that? And now, speaking of the Education Department, Bush met with five Texas reporters yesterday. And says, we should be teaching in our schools, in our science classes, we should be teaching that the world was created 6,000 years ago by a supreme being. By the supreme being of the Christian and Jewish Bible, specifically. Now, speaking as a Christian myself, I am offended by this. My particular interpretation of Scripture may be different than the interpretation of Scripture that George Bush is going to agree upon and put into the textbooks that are going to be presented to my children and grandchildren. I'm sorry, it doesn't fly. Within Christianity, there are dozens of different opinions about what the Genesis story means, or the Genesis stories, I should actually say. There's two of them. Read the second and third chapter of Genesis. And, you know, those stories raise a few questions. Remember Adam and Eve, the first parents, had two kids, Cain and Abel. Cain killed Abel. Cain gets banished. Banished to where? Well, he gets banished to another country where he goes and marries somebody. Oh, wait a minute. I thought Adam and Eve were the only parents. Who did Cain marry? No explanation, but we can tell you evolution isn't real. See here now I'm imposing upon you my interpretation. I'm not going to go any farther with it because this is not a religious show, first of all. That's not what this is about. That's the whole point of it. The government should not be teaching our children religion and calling it science. And I think it's just fine. Now, you know, the premise of what Bush is saying, that we should teach comparative religion. I mean, that's how he's trying to cast it. I agree with. I think it's a good idea for kids to understand that most religions have creation myths, creation stories. You know, whether it's the great turtle or whether it's the universe growing out of a lotus from Brahma's navel or whichever Hindu god it was. It's been years. I forget. Or whether, you know, intelligence moved and the universe came into being. I mean, you know, and then, of course, then he asked the question, where did the supreme being come from? And then at that point, oh, we don't want to talk about that either. But again, I don't want to turn this into a program on philosophy or religion, but the point is, Bush is using a fairly rational argument. That is, that it's probably a useful thing for people to at least understand comparative religion to promote an incoherent strategy, or not incoherent, an inappropriate, an anti-scientific strategy of replacing science instruction in our classrooms with an introduction of a debate between religion and science. Because creation science is nothing more than, you know, I mean, this is just, or intelligent design is nothing more than creation science, which is nothing more than one particular variation of a very fundamentalist variety of, by and large, Protestant Christianity. You know, a branch of Protestant Christianity to which I have belonged, but nonetheless, which, in my opinion, should not be inflicted upon our children as this is how it is. It should, you know, here is our creation story. This is our particular myth. And, you know, that's fine. You know, and here's what the Hindus think, and here's what the Buddhists think, and here's what the Muslims think, and here's what the Cherokee, here's the Apache creation myth. Here's the creation myth from the Eskimos. So the program advisor for the Center for Science and Culture, considered the father of the intelligence design movement, a guy by the name of Philip E. Johnson, born in 1940. He's a retired American law professor and author, born-again Christian. He's the guy who, the father of intelligent design. He's also one of the guys who's running around saying that HIV virus does not cause AIDS, by the way. This is like the father of pseudoscience. So, you know, it's a lot going on, I got to say. Just a lot going on. It's like, how do you keep up with it all? You know, it's just a lot flying by here in the Bush administration. And on top of that, then they're screwing up our country with crazy trade deals, crazy tax rules. The NLRB now saying, National Labor Relations Board now saying that if you work in a union shop, you cannot talk to people in your union outside of work hours. Now, I'm a member of a union, AFTRA, the American Federation of Television and Radio Actors. And does that mean that the people who work at the radio station that I work at, and I can't go out and have a beer after? Apparently! This is the Bush Labor Department. Logan in New York City is on the line. Hey, Logan, what's on your mind today?
Hey, what's up? You should ask Bush whether he wants us to teach about the stork.
Yeah, there you go. And babies are found under cauliflowers. I'm sure he's all in favor of it.
Yeah. But anyway, my question is about CAFTA. Given that this is just the way things are going, isn't there a way to make these CAFTA and NAFTA work, or is it just doomed? I mean,
they're doomed. There's no way to make them work because they're the fundamental premise upon which they're based, which is that if you allow multinational corporations to define the rules of the game, everything's going to be fine. That fundamental premise is flawed. It's wrong.
Yeah, but I mean, suppose we all had one currency, for example.
Then we would all have the same standard of living.
Yeah.
And what happens is you take the you know, 100 million people down south and 100 million people up here and try and balance it out. And what's going to happen is, and this is what's happening, by the way, as a result of globalization, is that everybody who has built a nation, because essentially this is all about national boundaries. I mean, we saw the same thing with states earlier in the after the 50s. But in any case, everybody who's built a nation that has a relatively high standard of living is going to see their standard of living decline. And in theory, the really poorest nations are going to see their standard of living increase. But because of the way it's been played out with multinational control, even the poor nations are not seeing their standard of living increase at the level of the average person. Only their wealthy are getting dramatically wealthier. So, you know, if you were to aggregate all the wealth of the nation and take their wealthiest people and their poorest people, you could say, yes, there's actually more wealth in Mexico now, but there's also much more poverty. Because this is a system, the CAFTA and NAFTA are systems, and WTO and GATT are systems that are designed to concentrate wealth in the hands of a very small number of people and rip off wealth from everybody else. That's the bottom line, Logan. It's just that simple, and you just have to walk away from them. 10 minutes before the hour.
fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And I'm taking my country back. Son, you ain't been doing her right. Oh, I've been watching you and I don't like how you've been treating my stars and stripes.
Ah, yes, we're going to take our country back.
Overseas. Now we owe billions to the red Chinese. You blew the budget and you bossed Iraq. So I'm taking my country back.
And welcome back, my friends.
We had a bundle in the treasury drawer, more than there had ever been before. But every day we're down and deeper in debt. Maybe 4 years should be all you get. Then you gave tax breaks to the millionaires, and you tried to make the working man pay. But you can't tax a man when his job's not there. Now look at where we are.
Yes, welcome back, my friends. We're taking our country back. 1-866-889-8894. I'm Tom Hartman. I noticed on one of these blogs here, Democrats.org, the blog, they quoted an article that I wrote for Common Dreams suggesting that we should have a national exit poll that we should be planning on. Skip in Tucson, Arizona. You got thoughts on that, Skip?
Yeah, Tom.
Or about Ohio? What's up?
Well, I thought I had heard right after the 2004 election, you know, first they Republicans were sort of denouncing the exit polls and stuff like that. But then I thought I heard something about the Republicans proposing electronic exit polls. Have you heard anything about that? Or
No, what I got, and I reported on this, I wrote about this, is that, first of all, the exit polls showed that Bush lost by 3 million votes. The electronic voting machines say that he won by 2 million. So there's a 5 million vote discrepancy. But the exit polls clearly show that he lost. After the election, the organization that did the exit polls, Mitofsky Edison, recalibrated their polls, taking into consideration the results of from the voting machine so that the polls were consistent with what the voting machine said, number one. Number two, right after that, the chairman of the Republican National Committee came out, the former Enron lobbyist and chairman of the Republican National Committee came out and said that we should do away with exit polls. We shouldn't have them anymore because the last three elections, 2000, 2004, and 2006, the exit polls, excuse me, 2000, 2002, and 2004, the exit polls had all been wrong. And therefore, it was disheartening to Republicans, because the exit polls kept showing that the Democrats were winning, but the electronic voting machines were saying the Republicans were winning. And so he said, you know, we need to do away with the exit polls. And that's where it stands right now. So far as I know, no plans for exit polls. Skip, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. We've got to wrap the show up. Thanks for being with us today. Thanks to Scott for engineering our program, to Louise for producing it. Thanks to you for listening, to Small Dog Electronics and our other sponsors for keeping us on the air, keeping us going. Thanks to the folks in our chat room for showing up. Great to see you there. To Shelby and Ben for streaming us on the web at WhiteRoseSociety.org and at RadioPower.org. Oh, boy, wait a minute, where did that come from? Anyhow, I'm Tom Hartman. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.